Dr. Zahler works as an assistant professor of medicine at the Warren Albert Medical School and is a researcher at Miriam Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island. So welcome.
Yeah, theme here is most of the people in the books don't actually present, so I'm same thing. My colleague Michelle couldn't be here. And then I'm required to put this. Have any of you guys gone to a presentation where someone says, I have significant relationships and my relationships are this, and they start getting in a real uncomfortable... You do have relationships?
No, I've heard it.
Oh. I'm going off on some rant and you're like, oh, and I'm sitting next to you, so I don't... Okay. Anyway, I don't have anything to disclose. Thank you. Okay. So I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach. I'm talking about people actually that are in treatment, and then what happens when folks are arrested, because we look at addiction and we talk about substance use as a disease, and what I think is interesting, it's the only disease for which it is a crime to be sick. So we've got a ton of people that we've locked up. We've got about 10 million people that cycle in and out of corrections each year. And most of the people that go through corrections don't get treatment. So it is the policy of correctional institutions not to provide treatment. They don't really feel it's indicated, don't really feel that there's issues with whether or not people think addiction is a legitimate disease. And even though we have, quite honestly, a ridiculous amount of evidence about opioid substitution therapy, we all know about it. Methadone, for example, has been studied since the 70s, and yet still, we have tremendous amounts of stigma, and we have a tremendous problem in the correctional system of trying to implement methadone maintenance or even methadone during short-term incarceration. What happens is not surprising. We have a chronic relapsing illness left untreated. A lot of times people are going to relapse. And in particular, the period immediately following incarceration is extraordinarily high risk. Within the first 2 weeks, there's been several studies that have come out in the last 5 or so years really looking at increased risk for overdose fatality. As someone goes in, their tolerance goes down, they go out and they say, okay, wow, I'm back on the street again, let me use the same amount of heroin I used before, and they wind up dead. And then we, a lot of us know about the disproportionate burden of infectious diseases and a lot of other health comorbidities that also are in the correctional populations. So, some of the things that, we've learned, and people have sort of talked about this, and, this is not really a drug policy talk, so, we control-oriented interventions, we're not really doing much with our epidemic of addiction by just locking people up. I'm going to talk about pharmacological replacement, in particular methadone. And again, we know that it's effective, not so much for treating addiction per se. Methadone in many circles it's kind of people still go back and forth, is it really harm reduction? And, my sense is that it largely is, because really what it is blocking the opioid receptors in the brain, so therefore it is a true replacement therapy and is not going to do anything about cocaine addiction or taking benzodiazepine. It's not going to deal with the social ramifications of addiction. It's also not going to get people to erase their criminal history. And a longer duration, better outcomes. So the ways in which opioid replacement therapy is used now in corrections, typically to treat withdrawal symptoms, detox, sometimes in very rare occasions provide maintenance therapy, and that's primarily among pregnant women. In most correctional facilities throughout the country, those are one of the only exceptions where people will actually be continued or placed on maintenance therapy. And there have been a number of studies that have shown promise in initiating opioid replacement therapy, both methadone and buprenorphine, prior to release from corrections. So the purpose of this study that we're looking at, we're still recruiting, So these are some of the preliminary results. And we had a hypothesis. We were sort of talking, and several of our outreach workers came up with this idea. We said, well, you know, we have all these people that are arrested on methadone. You know, and then they are stable in the community, but of course, maybe they were violated for probation violation, wrong place, wrong time, happens all the time. And so then they're just getting detoxed off methadone, so when they get out, in addition to being very uncomfortable while they're inside, when they get out, they're at higher risk for relapse. And so we thought, well, what do we need to do to actually inform better correctional policy? What data is needed? And so really the impetus for doing this study is looking at, okay, we've got people that are stable, why don't we continue to make sure that they're stable? If you're on medication for diabetes, imagine if you said, okay, we're going to detox you from your diabetes medication. We're going to detox you from your hypertensive. We're just going to take it away. If you have a heart attack, oh well, but that's what we do for methadone. So two groups, standard group, treatment as usual, but the treatment as usual is really, I'm going to taper you off of your methadone because it's not a legitimate medication, you don't need it, versus maintaining someone at the dose that they came in on, they were arrested. And it's for short-term jail stays. So specific aims to determine, less than 6 months, again, typically within the first week in Rhode Island, the detox starts, so we have to catch them early. But we don't want them, obviously, if somebody's incarcerated several years, then really we're most focused on that immediate period post-release and people where this is really a treatment interruption. So people that are doing okay in the community, except they're arrested, and then they're taken off of their treatment, and then what happens to them. And we wanted to also look at HIV risk behaviors, primarily injection drug use, because most of these folks are injection drug users in the sample. And one of the other things that we wanted to look at is what is the cost effectiveness of this intervention, because a big thing with corrections is, well, we don't have any money, and our medical staff is already overtaxed, and we don't have the resources, so this is going to be a big investment. We have to make sure that this is really cost effective. This is being done in the Rhode Island Department of Corrections. So in Rhode Island, we're one of a couple of states that has a unified Department of Corrections. That means jail and prison is on the same sprawling, wondrous campus in Cranston, Rhode Island. Somebody was asking about, well, what happens, to the corrections if, during hurricane weather, but I think the walls are pretty strong, so they keep out the floodwaters, if anybody's concerned. And our target population, 450 was our target population in terms of the number of people total for our study. We're we're probably not going to get to 450, but hopefully we'll get somewhere in the ballpark. And looking at eligibility, I kind of went through some of this already. Enrolled in methadone at the time of incarceration, really between 1 week and 6 months of total jail time. This is in the jail facility. And obviously desire to remain on methadone treatment post-release. And I already mentioned the two arms. So basically, the assessments that we're doing, timeline follow-back to look at drug use, the ASI, the risk behavioral assessment, treatment service review. We're looking at methadone clinic data, Departments of Corrections data, and also we want to really follow up on overdose, in particular overdose mortality. So far to date, we've got approximately 100 people per group, 203 total, mostly men, which is par for the course in a lot of these studies. And it's interesting that in Rhode Island, even though most of the folks here come from Providence, and actually Caucasian race is the minority in the city of Providence, but the majority of people that go into methadone treatment are white. And we've never been able to figure this out. I spent a couple of years trying to look into why there's such a disparity in access to methadone treatment. That's another study. So interestingly, we looked at one drug use. So the data I'm going to have here are just 1 month, And again, I'm focusing on the one-month period because that's typically the highest risk period for relapse and then adverse events associated with relapse. This tox screen on the top is only among people that we could actually get tox screens from at the one-month date. It's not doesn't represent the total number of people interviewed. That's on the top. There are a million reasons why people can't give urine, as many of you probably know. So one of the things that we looked at is the profile in general. We still have a fair amount of drug use, cocaine in particular. Again, this is not surprising, and methadone is not effective for treating cocaine addiction. It's not a knock against methadone. It's just looking at other services that need to be provided. Of the 89 people in Arm 1 that's maintained, 85 of them were still have been prescribed methadone and were on methadone at 1 month, compared to 48 in Arm 2, which is the detoxed arm. The criminal behavior, there's not really a whole lot to report in terms of, you know, the people that have been rearrested, although you did have a fair amount of that, and reincarcerated. The one piece of information that I really am focusing on is retention at community methadone clinic at 1 month. So the majority of people in Arm 1, and this was our primary hypothesis, that if you maintain people on methadone, you don't detox them, they're going to quickly reintegrate, get back to their community clinic, and carry on. So preliminary data suggests that that's in fact what's happening. And in fact, some people that have gone through detox, detox from methadone is can be a very painful experience, and some people that go through it say it's worse than detoxing from heroin. So you have a good number of people that have actually gone through the detox process and have now said voluntarily, I don't want methadone anymore. I'm done. I don't want to go through that again. If I get rearrested and reincarcerated, I'm going to have to go through this whole process again. So that was really interesting. And in terms of injection drug use, we had a difference. We still had some injection-related behavior. Most of this is injection of cocaine, interestingly enough, particularly in Arm 1. And, you know, looking at the number of unprotected sex acts, pretty, it's fairly high, but many of these, when we stratify by main partners, some of the risk actually is not so significant. You know, again, the other interesting thing is from a policy perspective, again, our main focus here is getting people back plugged into their methadone program as quickly as possible, and we're finding that the vast majority of people who are maintained on methadone very quickly are able to go back to their community clinic, much more so than in Arm 2 folks that are detoxed. But, you know, interestingly, you still have 51 out of 60 in Arm 2 that are going back to their clinic. So again, whether or not they're detoxing or not, there's a clear desire for people to go back into community treatment, especially if they were in treatment prior to their arrest. So, you know, some of the policy implications for this is, again, this we're still enrolling probably through the end of next year. And then we'll kind of look at all of the data that we've got, and we're doing 1 month, 6 month, and 12 month follow-ups on folks. And so, you know, part of this is what is really going to, at the end of the day, what's going to happen, what's going to change. You know, 55% of state prison systems offer methadone to anyone, and again, most of that is for pregnant women. And only 14% of state prisons offer buprenorphine, and most of that is very limited. Here's a map that just looks at distribution of ORT in U.S. prisons. So I think, you know, the biggest issue that we have here is you have people that are on a medication and they're being withdrawn from the medication, which is a very painful experience. Again, in some cases people say it's worse than heroin. So then they are at higher risk for relapse and overdose getting out. So, you know, we hope to say to correctional institutions and just to say that, you know, this is a public health priority. And the fact is, why do we treat methadone so much differently than other medications for other chronic illnesses? There doesn't really seem to be any rationale other than stigma and bias. And, you know, again, the main way to break this revolving door of, you know, people relapsing and being rearrested really is to engage people in long-term treatment. So finally, that just kind of sums up what I just said. We know that linkage to methadone is effective and it works. And our preliminary data suggests that if you keep people on stable doses of methadone, they're able to reconnect with their clinic quickly after they're released. And just to acknowledge my collaborators and grant support, and that's all. Thanks.